Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Uprising Uncut. I believe this is episode number 5. It is September 24th, 2015, and my name is Sonali Kolhatkar. You might know me through my work on KPFK on a program called Uprising, or from Free Speech TV, or even KPFA in Berkeley. And boy, what a week it has been for me, and actually what a day it has been. Today, I had an op-ed published in the Los Angeles Times, and while ordinarily I would be absolutely thrilled and excited about having an opinion piece published in such a high-profile newspaper, I'm so sad because the topic was not about, you know, a piece of really important political analysis on the world stage. It was about the problems that KPFK, my very own radio station, is having. It's interesting, actually. This morning, the op-ed started out online with the headline, "The Perils of Public Radio Station KPFK." And then by this evening, they changed the headline to "Death by Democracy." So same material, different headline. Not sure what the decision-making process of the LA Times about that stuff is. And I didn't get a chance to pick up an actual physical copy of the paper, so I have no idea what it was named in the paper. I'm guessing it was named The Perils of Public Radio. So that was this morning. There's also an article in the Pasadena Weekly that was based on interviews that I and others did. You can check it out on your own, make your own decision. And then, incidentally, on the very same day, today, that my LA Times op-ed got published, my weekly column at Truthdig was published as well, which is not unusual. Usually my columns get published on Thursdays. And then my article for Telesur, my second piece this month, and I write semi-regularly for Telesur English, which is the Venezuelan media outlet, that also got published today. So three pieces out in one single day. I did not expect that or plan for it, and it just kind of coincidentally happened that way. And I want to tell you a little bit about the pieces that I've published because I haven't had a chance to talk about them on the radio. And the piece that I wrote for Truthdig is in particular very close to my heart. It is about the situation in Afghanistan, and the title of the piece was "Murder, Mayhem, and Rape in Afghanistan, Made in the USA." There was just a horrific article in the New York Times recently about essentially rampant sexual abuse of boys, but also girls, mostly boys, but also girls, by military commanders in Afghanistan. So Afghan leaders, mostly military leaders, what we would colloquially call warlords, and essentially allies of the United States. And this article in the New York Times was horribly disturbing. Really a good piece, by the way. And of course, the Times, you know, does some absolutely brilliant journalism often. And this article was about U.S. soldiers who finally realized that they couldn't, these are individuals, you know, the rank and file, who just realized that they could not look the other way any longer because this was happening under their very noses. Wow, by the way, can you hear my, that's my cat meowing. Can you hear that? My 16-year-old cat named Chomsky. Yes, I named my cat Chomsky. And he is 80-something in cat years, just about the same age as the real Chomsky. And he gets lonely once in a while and starts, you know, making these horrible guttural meowing sounds. And I think my husband just went to shut him up. But back to the article on Afghanistan, these rank and file U.S. soldiers had, you know, just been unable to say anything more, unable to keep silent about what they were witnessing under their very noses, these militia leaders sexually abusing young Afghan boys. And it's a thing in Afghanistan. It is. And it's more of a thing now because the men that like to practice the sadism are the ones that have received the most power and the money and have basically gotten undue influence throughout Afghan society because the U.S. has for decades supported them and empowered them. Our policy in Afghanistan goes back decades, 30, 40 years, where we have taken the worst elements of Afghan society and showered them with weapons and money and political support and power and training. And so those worst elements have flourished. And so child rape today among military commanders in Afghanistan is the norm. And U.S. soldiers have been told routinely to simply look the other way. And my article pointed out that this is not something that should surprise us at all, because that's been our policy for, you know, going on 14 years. You know, we're just heading into the towards the 14th anniversary of the start of the Afghanistan war on October 7th of this year. And our policy right from the start was to work with criminal warlords and to look the other way when they, you know, committed mass murder, which is what Abdulrashid Dostum did, who's now the vice president of Afghanistan. He was implicated so strongly in the mass murder of hundreds, perhaps thousands of Taliban soldiers that he captured after the U.S. began bombing Afghanistan in 2001, that you know, major human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch and others denounced it, and the U.S. just looked the other way. We couldn't investigate somebody who'd, after all, been on the CIA payroll for years. And, you know, same goes for the drug manufacturing and sales. The U.S. has, over the past 14 years, simply looked the other way as drug lords and narco traffickers have just, you know, nurtured an incredible bonanza of heroin and opium over the years and allowed this drug trade to flourish. And at the same time as you have this phenomenon of poppy palaces, literally garish, fancy mansions built from drug money for warlords, you have the accompanying phenomenon of villages, whole villages of addicts, poor Afghan women, children, men who've gotten addicted and, you know, who live in despair. And so this is our doing, hence Made in the USA in the title of the piece that I wrote for Truthdig. So do check it out, truthdig.com. Do spread it and share it. Coming up on the 14th anniversary of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, which makes it the longest war the U.S. has ever officially waged. Do share this article if you can and raise awareness about what our policies have been. Also, you may not know, but about 10 years ago, 9 years ago now, I co-wrote a book about Afghanistan called Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. My husband was actually my co-writer, Jim Ingalls. And I'm very proud of the work that we did in that book. It was, I think, a really important book that didn't get enough attention because we just weren't interested back then in the Afghanistan war. All attention was fixated on Iraq. Anyway, and then, so the other article that I wrote that also came out today, which is Thursday, on the same day as the LA Times op-ed and the Truthdig piece, was in Telesur English, and it was about the Pope. And, you know, the country, the entire United States seems to, you know, minus the right-wing media and politicians, so most of the entire sane United States seems to have caught Pope fever. And, you know, that's not surprising. He is such a likable guy, right? He has put forward some very progressive policies. He seems to be pushing the Catholic Church far more to the left than it was. He's certainly extremely problematic on certain issues, abortion rights for women, ordination of women, gay marriage. He still seems at least more open to embracing progressive policies than other popes on the issues of income inequality, climate change, international relations, refugees, immigration. He is, I would say, quite strongly to the left. So the country has Pope fever, which is quite exciting. Everybody got excited about the 5-year-old girl named Sophia Cruz, who broke through the security barricades and was allowed to give, you know, the Pope a hug and delivered a letter to him, a moving letter about the fears that she had about her undocumented parents being deported. And that was an important moment, I thought, a real moment of humanity and compassion that I hope will highlight in this country how important it is for us to treat immigrants, particularly those fleeing violence and poverty in Latin America, as refugees in the same light that we see, you know, in the same compassionate lens through which we see Syrian refugees today. These are refugees in our midst, you know, here in the United States. It's perhaps easier to show compassion to those people who are so far away from us. But what about those refugees in our very midst? So that, I thought that was a really great moment. But the other aspect of the Pope's visit, which has not gotten very much attention from the big media, has been the Pope's canonization of Father Junipero Serra. I don't know if it's Junipero or Junipero, anyway. Or the anglicized version would be Junipero Serra, the Spanish priest who in the late 1800s took over major California missions. He was the Padre Presidente, as he was called, of California missions, whose sole purpose it was to convert Native Americans to Catholicism, convert by any means necessary. And Pope Francis canonized, meaning essentially turned him into a saint, Father Serra, in Washington, D.C. at a ceremony. This was this week during the Pope's visit. And it became, Serra became the first person to be sainted on U.S. soil. How sad that that honor went to somebody who condoned rape, torture, and mass murder in the name of Catholicism. That's essentially what he did. I did this great interview some days back with Valentin Lopez, who is with the Amamatsun tribe in California, who's been leading protests in Sacramento against the canonization of Father Serra. And my article for Telesur was based on this interview, and it was powerful. And he just explained how essentially, California's Indian population, American Indian population, was wiped out almost. You know, there's this just so few tribes left. The tribal populations are so small compared to what they were in their heyday. He pointed out that in the coastal California native communities were the most densely populated indigenous communities north of Mexico until Father Serra brought his vicious and brutal brand of evangelizing to California, and where once there were tens of thousands of people, now only a few hundred remained. So this story should have been front and center, you know, on CNN and the front pages of the New York Times. As Pope Francis was canonizing Father Serra, this should have been front and center. A lot of public radio covered it, community media covered it, California newspapers covered it, small newswire services covered it, but the big, big media didn't cover it. It wasn't a matter of, you know, it wasn't a topic on Sunday news shows, talk shows, and it probably won't be this coming Sunday either. And that's a shame. So my piece on Telesur English is about that. I highly recommend my colleague Rose Aguilar. She wrote a piece in the Guardian newspaper. I love Rose, by the way. She's just a fantastic radio commentator, just this beautiful, strong woman, fierce media maker. She used to do a regular commentary on Uprising years ago. So she wrote this great piece in the Guardian newspaper about Father Serra as well that I just saw today. So I recommend that piece as well. And yeah, it's been a busy week. You know, people ask me, God, how do you do all of the stuff you do? Where do you find the time? And, you know, I have kids. I have a 2.5-year-old and an 8-year-old. And when I'm done with work, I pick up my 2.5-year-old at 3 in the afternoon, 3:30, I pick up my 8-year-old. I bring the kids home. We're home by around 4, and between 4 and 5:30, I'm cooking dinner, you know, and I find it extremely important to sit down to a family meal every evening, and we make a home-cooked meal, and my family and I sit down to eat dinner at 5:30, and sometimes it's kind of chaotic. There's, you know, food fights and screaming matches because, well, there's a 2.5-year-old involved, but But it's good. It's important. And by 7, I put the younger one to bed. By 8, my husband puts the older one to bed. And so essentially, my life kind of begins, part 2 of my work day, if you will, begins at around 7, between 7 and 8 p.m. at night. And so Tuesday night, I write my Truth Dig articles, my Truth Dig columns every Tuesday night. That's a weekly column. Telesaurus, twice a month, sometimes once a month. And so when I do get the chance, I might write those on a Wednesday night. And then Thursday nights, I do my podcast. And Fridays, I take the night off. And incidentally, I should say, this Friday, I have a date with my girlfriend, one of my closest friends, and I are going to see the play Real Women Have Curves at the Pasadena Playhouse. I am so excited about this. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this, it was, you know, became famous. Real Women Have Curves was initially a play by a local Los Angeles-based playwright named Josefina Lopez, just a brilliant, brilliant playwright. I've had her on my show. And so the play was so successful, it was turned into a movie. That is the movie that made America Ferrera famous, of Ugly Betty fame. And now the Real Women Have Curves has come back to the stage, and it's at the Pasadena Playhouse. So my close friend and I are going to go and see that for Girls Night Out on Friday evening at the Pasadena Playhouse. Maybe I'll run into some of my listeners there, but it's I'm so excited about it. It's sure to be really, really wonderful. But yeah, that is my week for the week. I want to spend the rest of the podcast kind of going over some of the stories that I didn't get a chance to talk about on the air. Well, because I'm actually not on the air live for half the week. And so it makes it a little bit harder to keep up with the news when you're just doing a show half the week. But there were 3 stories around sort of corporate wrongdoing, if you will, this week that caught my attention. So there was this massive, like, internet hate fest against Martin Shkreli, this youngish, really kind of douchebag looking, I'm sorry to say it, former hedge fund manager turned pharmaceutical big shot. He just, you know, he has that face. If you look him up, you'll see what I mean. His last name, Shkreli, Shkreli. I'm not sure what the ethnicity is. It's an interesting name. But he bought up a drug called Daraprim, D-A-R-A-P-R-I-M, Daraprim, which is used to treat toxoplasmosis. And so it's a drug that often people with suppressed immune systems need. So people who have HIV or have been struggling with cancer. And the pill used to cost $13.50 a pill. And he raised the price to $750 a pill. And yes, there is such a strong pun that's just right there, but I won't take the bait, but you know what I mean. And he came under fierce attacks from the internet. Basically, Twitter took to him and just beat him up, metaphorically speaking. And, you know, I kind of have conflicting feelings about when people get, you know, beaten up metaphorically on the internet. It's too easy to do that. It's so tempting to do that. And I admit, I've engaged in it. I think I, you know, probably partook of it during the whole Rachel Dolezal scandal. It's, you know, you get this feeling, you want to love to hate a person who proves to be so despicable that, you know, you want to pile on and all of a sudden there's a mob mentality and you go, you know, this person who is the focus of all the wrath goes viral negatively, you know, becomes the virus that that gets attacked. And I don't know, I feel like public shaming is always a double-edged sword, and You have to be careful about it. You never know when you're going to find yourself on the receiving end of it. And possibly because somebody decided to juxtapose certain facts together that make you look really, really bad. So, for example, in the case of Martin Shkreli, there's a photograph of him going around alongside the criticisms of him jacking up the price of this drug. And it's this photograph where he just basically looks like an asshole. He's got that frat boy look, and he's, I believe he has sunglasses, I should look it up, but he just, you know, it's the perfect photo to showcase the callousness that would explain why somebody would, you know, be so heartless in enabling the rise in prices. Now, I want to hate Martin Shkreli too, but I also want to hate the system that allows Martin Shkrelis to get away with what they're doing. Why is what he did legal? Why should public shaming be the force that tempers people? Shouldn't we be pushing for government regulation so that no pharmaceutical company could do this? And plenty have done it. Martin Shkreli isn't the first one to do it, but, you know, he's an easy target. But, you know, also, we do have to be careful. I mean, when people gang up on one person, you can traumatize them so deeply that it could have unintended impacts. And, you know, it reminds me of the sort of parenting advice that you get when you first have kids. And parents and among you listeners may know what I'm talking about. You know, when you have a kid, you're never supposed to get upset at them. You know, if they've done something wrong, you tell them that you're mad at their behavior and not mad at them, that their behavior was wrong, but that they aren't bad people. You target the kid's behavior and not their person. And so I think it's kind of useful to apply that in our interactions with each other online, that we need to attack people's policies and their behavior, but not their person. And to try not to let it get too personal, to point out their behavior, point out the consequences of their behavior. Anyway, that I got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but it was definitely an important moment that I hope the takeaway from that isn't hedge fund managers turn pharmaceutical CEOs are total jerks, but rather the fact that individuals can jack up the prices of drugs that we buy, you know, and that this is legal. I hope that's the takeaway, and that we need to change that. I hope that is the takeaway. And in fact, there is an investigation ongoing. Bernie Sanders and another member of Congress, whose name I can't remember, he is inquiring into, and it's becoming actually an election issue now, which is good, the rising price of pharmaceuticals. The other big story that around corporate malfeasance that's been making waves over the past week is the Volkswagen, I'll say, they use a German pronunciation, the VW controversy. And boy, was this serious deception. So if you haven't come across this story, look up VW. And essentially, this was around clean, you know, so-called clean diesel. So the company marketed these cars that were supposedly going to pass inspections, that were designed to pass inspections to show that they had low emissions, except the company actually designed the cars to deceive the tests, not to spew out fewer emissions or cleaner emissions. A mechanism kicked in when the cars were tested. That is incredible. So built-in deception. I mean, think about the chain of command that had to be involved in creating and maintaining this deception. And it went on for years till it was discovered that people who are involved in the design aspect, the testing aspect, the writing off in the entire VW corporate chain thought that this was okay to do, thought this was a good enough idea, And nobody stopped to either blow the whistle on it or to say, whoa, whoa, I don't want anything to do with this, or we can't do this. Or maybe they didn't, they were shut down or bribed, who knows? But it's unbelievable. It's really, really amazing what corporate America thinks it can get away with. And perhaps they even calculated, well, if we get caught, we'll probably be fined this much, and that's the cost of doing business, the amount of money we will have saved from not actually building in more efficient cars is worth the price. And it's a the corporations account for the cost of doing business, which is, you know, screwing us, screwing the planet. So that was my second story around corporate wrongdoings, corporate thuggery, corporate bullshit over this past week. My favorite story, and the one that has the least impact on anything real, but just because it gave me great mental satisfaction, was that Warner Brothers lost the rights to the song Happy Birthday. Did you know that the song Happy Birthday was copyrighted, or at least Warner Chappell, which is the publishing arm of Warner Brothers, has claimed for 80 years that it owns the copyright to the song Happy Birthday? Yes, the thing that you sing to your kid, to each other, that you've sung all your life, every year, when you cut your cake on your birthday. Warner Brothers, you know, if you videotaped a birthday party and you put it on YouTube and you had ads on YouTube, Warner Brothers, before this federal judge made a decision, could have come after you for licensing fees for the song Happy Birthday. And in fact, they collected millions of dollars over the years in licensing fees, and a federal judge came and said, the song belongs to the public domain and all copyright claims are invalid. All claims over 80 years. I don't know whether that means that a court is going to force Warner Brothers and Warner Chappell to reimburse 80 years worth of licensing fees. Boy, that's going to be a bookkeeping nightmare. I don't know if they're going to do that or not. But I just enjoyed so much seeing a corporation lose. And you know what I said earlier about public shaming of individuals, I think none of that applies to public shaming of corporations. Remember, corporations are not people. Our legal system in many ways treats them as though they are people, but they are not people. We can and should shame corporations every chance we get when we see them doing stupid stuff, unjust things, exploit people, exploit the planet. Let's shame them. Let's call them out. Absolutely. So I just enjoyed seeing Warner Brothers lose the rights to Happy Birthday. So great. All right, I am almost out of time for this half hour of podcast. I just want to remind you to follow me on Facebook. I can be found at facebook.com/SonaliKolhatkar, and I post a lot of stuff on Facebook just because I have more than 140 characters. Twitter, to say what I want to say. I'm sorry. It's just, I need more than 140 characters. I hate writing in short form. I absolutely hate it. I hate shortening my words so that they're barely understandable. I know I just love to hate on Twitter, but I really do hate Twitter. But yes, you can, and I've been posting a lot about, you know, all the stuff happening at KPFK on my Facebook page. So all of my public posts are available at facebook.com/SonaliKolhatkar. Also, I'm still at Instagram. Do follow me at Instagram. I am an artist. That is another thing that I do when I'm not recording podcasts, when I'm not writing my weekly columns, when I'm not doing my show, making dinner for my kids, putting them to bed, loving them, I paint. And so you can see my paintings on my Instagram feed, instagram.com/SonaliKolhatkar. Thank you so much for listening to another half hour of me blabber on about stuff that moved me over the week, stuff that I want to share with the world, and do share this podcast as well, Uprising Uncut. Thank you so very much for listening.